from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll learn about the history of Wisconsin's Latino communities with the author of the book, Strangers No Longer. Then, three Milwaukeeans explore Asian identity.
I mean, for a lot of us, in the absence of language, you know, we have food. And it helped me feel connected to my grandparents when I couldn't really communicate with them.
Plus, we'll speak with the owners of La Finca Coffee House, a family-owned coffee shop specializing in Mexican cuisine.
I wanted to create something with my sister that not only highlighted our culture, but represented our family in a certain way so that we could get roots here.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. Milwaukee is known for its celebration of cultures, with its wide array of cultural festivals and the many cultural centers that call the city home. But Wisconsin's record of welcoming newcomers has been spotty, and that history hasn't always been well documented. Sergio Gonzalez is a Wisconsin native and Latino historian who was dismayed to find that much of his culture's history hadn't been researched. So he went about fixing that. His first book, Mexicans in Wisconsin, explores the history of Mexican immigrants in the state. His latest book, Strangers No Longer, explores the intersection of Latino belonging and faith in Wisconsin and how it informs our communities today. Gonzalez joined me earlier this year in studio.
Often when we talk about Wisconsin's Latino community, we talk about it in a couple key ways, as both a monolith and as a relatively new history, kind of from the 1990s onward. This book really dispels both of these notions. When do Latinos first start coming to Wisconsin?
Well, you know, the first recorded Latino, the one that we have historical record of, goes all the way back to the 19th century. But the large numbers of Latinos settling here really begins in the 1920s, when Mexican industrial workers were recruited to Milwaukee, Wisconsin, to serve as workers in tanneries, factories, and foundries. And in many ways, they were just kind of following the footsteps of the European immigrants who had preceded them. They were coming here as cheap, controllable labor, oftentimes were brought as strikebreakers without their knowledge. And so they had a really tough go of it trying to find a space to live in Wisconsin, trying to find work sites that paid them well, that treated them well. And it was not a very easy experience for them. Again, an experience that's very similar to other groups that had preceded them before.
One of the key words of this book is hospitality. And it's a word that you use in a kind of interesting way. When you say hospitality, what do you mean?
Well, you know, I think all Midwesterners have an understanding of hospitality. The way that it comes to us most is the idea of Midwestern nice, and every state has kind of its own version of it, whether it's Wisconsin nice or Minnesota nice. We like to think of ourselves as welcoming people. And I think in many ways, Wisconsinites have been welcoming to Latinos across the 20th century, but there are so many instances where Latino immigrants, migrants, and refugees have struggled to find a sense of welcome here. I like to think of welcoming as not just saying hello to somebody and bringing them into the table, but also offering them political power, social space, economic power as well. And so there's an entire field of study called hospitality studies that tries to understand the interaction between the person who is the in-group and those who kind of exist at the boundaries and kind of the conflicts, the tensions that arise when those out-group members try to become members of the in-group. And for the history of Latinos here in the state of Wisconsin, there has been a constant tension. We have moments of great community, of great collaboration between different communities, but also moments where there has been friction. And I think into the 21st century, we see that we're still working out a lot of those questions.
One of the ways that you describe this is the idea of the perpetual stranger, this idea that, I'll have you explain it.
Yeah. I mean, this is, for me, the framing of the book, of course, it's a question not just of Latinos arriving in Wisconsin, but how they've built community. And I look at the question of faith, specifically faith spaces and houses of worship. And within both the Old and New Testament, there's this constant evocation of the stranger and the obligation to the stranger, how Christians and Jews are supposed to welcome the person who exists at the gate. Now, the question, of course, becomes is if that person who is at the gate is consistently going to exist at the threshold of belonging, will they ever have an opportunity to actually be a full member of the community? And so I'm interested in, you know, as the book of Ephesians says, how can people become strangers no longer in a community they've called home for 100 years? And as I kind of note in the book, there's really an unresolved question here in whether or not Latinos are full members of their communities here in Wisconsin. I think many Latinos would call themselves Wisconsinites. I certainly do. I was born and raised here in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. But there is a constant tension of feeling, do I completely belong and do people want me to be here?
As you said, in the book, you really explore this through the church's relationship with Latino communities. Going back to when Latinos originally come to Wisconsin, how did churches, parishes initially welcome these new migrants?
Yeah, I love the beginning of the story because I think it throws a lot of us for a loop. We might think of this kind of a progressive history of Latinos arriving as very difficult at the beginning, and it gets better across the 20th century. But actually, perhaps the best moments of welcome, of integration, happened in the 1920s when Latinos arrive. They find a lot of friction in their workspaces and social spaces. They settle on the city's south side. But the place where they find a home is in their churches, specifically Catholic churches. And it's white Catholics on the city's south side, specifically at Holy Trinity Church, who open the doors and welcome into the pews these Mexican Catholics who are arriving into the city. And it's that shared sense of Catholicism, right? The shared faith that exists between the two groups, even if they speak a different language, they have different cultures, they have different ways of knowing this city, that they find a sense of communion, a sense of fellowship. And so some of the most robust senses of collaboration that happen among Latino newcomers and Milwaukeeans is in developing a Mexican mission chapel on 5th and National. And that building still exists here in Milwaukee in the Walker's Point neighborhood. Eventually, that church migrates into the Holy Trinity Church. And we now recognize it, of course, as Holy Trinity Our Lady of Guadalupe, which is really the heart of Latino Catholicism here in Milwaukee.
This relationship really does change through the decades. How do we see this evolve over time? When Latinos, of course, the communities that are here are also changing. We're getting new people in. But also the people who had been here initially are really have set down roots, have created communities. How does this relationship to the church change?
Yeah, well, I'm glad that you mentioned at the start of our conversation the fact that Latinos are not a monolith. And this is kind of represented in the different groups that arrive in Wisconsin at different points throughout the 20th century. So Mexican immigrants arrive in the 1920s. The group that follows them are Texas Mexican Americans. So these are American citizens who are born at the U.S.-Mexico borderlands. And they come to Wisconsin to do migrant work in the 1940s through the 1970s. Their experiences are very different because they're arriving in rural Wisconsin. They're here very much temporarily from the spring through the fall. And eventually, many of them settle here in places like Milwaukee, Madison, Kenosha, Racine. They're followed by groups like Puerto Rican industrial workers who are American citizens, but they're still treated like outsiders in many ways. They arrive here in Milwaukee as industrial workers in the 1950s. And then, of course, Cuban refugees in the 1960s and the 1980s, and Central American refugees who arrive in the 1980s who are fleeing persecution but find a limited sense of political harbor here in Wisconsin. And so all of these different groups, even though they fall under the large umbrella of Latino, Hispanic, Latinx, Latine, are having different experiences with the people who arrive here and different experiences with those established Latinos who have been here perhaps for decades before.
Now, your book explores how churches not only served as a place of worship, but also often a center for political and activist organization. How did that develop?
It was, I would say, very organic, and I think it's an experience that many people have with their churches. These are not just places of worship where they can pray to their Lord, where they can practice the scriptural teaching, where they can have a sense of community with people who are like-minded in their faith. It's also a place that can serve as a social service agency, a place of education, not just parochial schools, but, you know, people learning English. And then ultimately can also be a place for political empowerment and political mobilization. So there are different moments where this happens. Of course, in the 1920s, those first Mexican migrants who arrive here, some of them are political refugees who are arriving from Mexico fleeing persecution because of their faith during a period that was known as the Cristero War in Mexico when the Mexican state went to war with the Mexican Catholic Church. And that extends into the 1960s, migrant farm workers who turned to their churches to organize their labor unions and to boycott grapes to support migrant farm workers across the United States. And then, of course, maybe most dramatically in the 1980s with the birth of the sanctuary movement, where churches literally become places of safe harbor for political refugees fleeing fleeing persecution in El Salvador and Guatemala. And Milwaukee serves as a central hub for the sanction movement beginning in December of 1982 and extending all the way through the 1980s. And I think today we can still see this to this day, where Latinos turn to their churches for a number of different reasons. Again, as a place of solace, a place of fellowship, a place of faith, but also as a place of political mobilization.
Now, this is a book that was, in some ways, really born out of your desire to add to this history where there really wasn't a lot that was in a collected space. You start the book, of course, with a story about going to the library, asking for, you know, all the materials on Latino history in Milwaukee, and then finding a photo of yourself, of course.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a stunning story. You know, you have these existential moments when you say, am I doing what I'm supposed to be doing with my life? And my first experience in the archives as a young graduate student was to literally find myself in the first document that I pulled out of a box. It was, obviously hair-raising, and it kind of really shook me. But then I put my historian's hat on, and I got to thinking about a few different things. One, the fact that there was such a limited number of archives that have been preserved about my community. And I got to thinking, what does it mean that our historical societies, our libraries, our historians have done such a pitiful job of commemorating a history that I believe is central not just to our past as a state, but is fundamental to understanding where we're going as a state moving forward. And then I got to thinking, of course, what does it mean when I pull this first image out of the box? It was a picture of me and my parents and my family walking out of a church. And that really oriented my understanding of what it means to create community, right? Looking at these different institutions that can exist in many different varieties, not just as places of worship, but of social services and of political mobilization. I'm really fortunate today that I'm not doing this work by myself. There's a growing network of Latino historians across Wisconsin, across the Midwest, who are trying to put our region on the map, right? To say that, of course, we have to focus on the Southwest, in New York City, and Miami, where there are these large Latino populations. But the fastest growing Latino populations are in the U.S. South and the U.S. Midwest. And here in Wisconsin, of course, we can look at any number of urban areas or rural areas and know that absent Latino growth and absent Latino populations, we would see net demographic decline. And so we are literally the future of this state in so many different ways. It's imperative for us to look to the past, to rectify these archival accidents, archival problems, archival lackings, and fill them in with the histories of this community.
Well, I'm sure many people are very excited to read the book. I very much enjoyed it. Sergio, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you, Joy. I appreciate it.
Sergio Gonzalez is an assistant professor of history at Marquette University and the author of Strangers No Longer, Latino Belonging and Faith in 20th Century Wisconsin. The book was published in March, and that's when he joined me to talk about it. Back in May, during Asian American and Pacific Islander Heritage Month, we brought you local voices talking about their experiences growing up in and around Milwaukee and trying their best to fit in, even in their own cultures. Here's WUWM's Jimmy Gutierrez and Lena Tran.
Something that's been interesting to me is that a lot of my friends have brought this up, and they've talked about this for a while, but this kind of feeling that they're not Asian enough or they don't feel Asian enough.
That is so real. I think that, you know, feeling a little out of place, whether you're first gen, second gen, I have aunts and uncles who immigrated here, like, as really young kids from Vietnam. You know, I think it's something that a lot of Asian Americans can relate to. I know I can for sure.
What is your background, if I can ask?
Yeah. So my mom is Thai and my dad is Vietnamese. And we have a huge family. Like cousins on cousins on cousins. I grew up with all of them living in my hometown in Alabama.
Alabama,
a really small town in Alabama. It was really white, and my high school was really segregated.
So we know that story.
if people saw any Asians walking around town, they probably assumed that they were my family members, and they were probably correct. Like, that's what we were working with.
Okay. Okay, understood. That's that sounds like a lot. And I can't imagine how confusing that would have been, like, growing up and trying to make sense of things. How did you feel like you fit in, or how did you kind of make space for yourself, or how did your family make space for themselves?
My grandparents worked really hard and eventually opened a restaurant that everyone in the family worked at. And, you know, we were a big part of the church. People knew our family, and I felt really proud to be, like, one of the trans. But I think so often I, like, think about how it was to be in that kind of family and be, like, kind of standing out. Mm-hmm. And it was, like, so often I saw us on, like, other people's terms, on, like, white people's terms. Mm. Like, I knew that we were different, but I didn't really understand how until I left home and was a lot older. I knew that we were different, but I also didn't know that it was, like, something that I could be proud of.
You know, that story reminds me of Kayla Kuo's story. And she's Taiwanese and grew up around Milwaukee, but she's also a transracial and transnational adoptee, which basically means she was raised and adopted by a white family. And has never met her birth family. And she said that growing up, she rejected her Asian-ness, even actively tried to assimilate to whiteness.
And so, to be honest, I didn't even think about race or not identifying as white until I went to college and was just surrounded by so many people of color and introduced to so many different ethnicities and cultures and just experiences that I had never even thought about or thought were possible for me. I do have a younger sister who's also a Korean adoptee. And it's so wild because I feel like growing up, people would tell us that my sister and I looked alike, which is like, of course, we kind of clung to that because the idea of being able to have representation or to feel this like familiarity with someone else was really lovely. But now the older I get and the more I think about it, it's just like, we absolutely look nothing alike. It was just people weren't exposed to or don't know that even the like minor differences between like someone who is Taiwanese and someone who's Korean. Growing up, I feel like my parents never exposed my sister and I to any like Asian dishes. I remember like growing up on Hamburger Helper and Rice-A-Roni and you know these like staple American pantry dishes, but like the closest that we ever got was like going to PF Chang's for our birthday and eating like lettuce wraps and the sweet and sour chicken. And so like I feel like I had a lot of growing to do in terms of understanding my racial identity because of what I wasn't exposed to. Even going to like the Asian grocery store, like I want to get to a place where I feel like I belong and that I feel welcome there, but still, even when I walk in, like I just get easily overwhelmed with all of the different labels and all of these words that I can't read. And so for me, I think it's also letting go of this shame of not having grown up speaking Mandarin Chinese or even Taiwanese. It's a continuous process of like learning how to let go of that shame and also give myself the experiences that I never had.
Yeah, not having a language connection is really painful. And like for me, it meant not being able to talk to my grandparents or feeling left out when my mom and aunts and cousins started speaking in Thai. Because in my family, like my siblings and I didn't learn our parents' languages, but we have some cousins that did. So there was this whole like spectrum of like some people who have that access and some people that don't. And it felt really bad to be someone that
didn't.
Oh,
no. Oh, no.
Yeah. The lack of language also makes it hard to access your family history. You know, I have friends who have photos of like their great-great-great-grandmother and they have stories that are passed down, you know, generation to generation. And I barely knew my grandparents' full names until very recently. You know, there's like so many questions that I have that were very difficult to ask.
Well, I know there were people that kind of rejected parts of them, like Kayla kind of talks about. Like you were saying with the language and just kind of like trying to piece things together, I do know of people that really like latched onto any part of their Asianness that they could in places that didn't have a lot of Asian representation.
Yeah.
And for that, I'm thinking of Adam Carr.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you met Adam Carr. He's from Milwaukee. He'll tell you that himself within the first minute that you meet him. But he's half Irish and half Chinese. And of all the places he could find representation, he found it in pop culture, even if sometimes it was a bit of a problem.
You know, as a little boy, you're interested in fighting, right? Like, at French immersion school, we were just fighting all the time. That's what we like to do. But, like, so ninjas were appealing to me. I think they're generally appealing. And then, like, the movies we'd watch, like, we're still the American ninja, and it's like a white guy becoming a ninja. And then all the Asian guys are bad guys, and just, like, the one white guy's a good guy. And then American Ninja 2, same. Did not change the formula. They didn't broaden their idea of what American could be at all. And then it took until Wu-Tang. It quickly became apparent. I'm listening to Wu-Tang. They know so much more about Chinese stuff than me. At least they were watching Kung Fu movies where everyone was Chinese. And it took, and Wu-Tang was like, yeah, you can like that too. And I was like, oh, interesting. Culture was a contact sport at MPS. In our era especially, I would grow up in super multicultural environments where it was also like, okay, I'm going to learn about these cultures' weak points. Or like, what? And by that, I mean, like, what are the stereotypes? So here's my choice. Do I learn to take it from someone, or do I learn to, like, get out ahead of the ribs and sort of, like, my mom does not have an accent, but I'm sure, well, I know in high school, like, she did when it was worth, you know, getting some laughs, right? Which, you know, it's regrettable in retrospect, but, like, it's like, oh, I could claim those. So there are a lot of things I couldn't say, and I never will say, and that's great, and I'm happy not to say them. But then there are some taboo things I can say.
Too real. Like, if you can't beat them, join them.
Dude, it's a dog-eat-dog world in those MPS hallways. I'm telling you. But luckily, we grow up, and we find ways to accept ourselves fully. Kayla did. For her, it was in books, and that transformed the way that she saw herself and the world around her.
When I was, like, in eighth grade or freshman, books for me really became a way to escape reality and to follow these fun, magical adventures of friendship and the possibilities of what could be. And so Harry Potter was kind of like my opening into my deep love for books and, like, that thread of why I want to read, which is often coming back to reading for pleasure and, like, reading to learn and to understand. And so it wasn't until, like, even after college that I finally had, you know, time to read again for fun. But when I was on this, you know, consistent journey of decentering whiteness, I realized that a lot of the books that I was reading were either written by white authors and or featured, like, white straight protagonists. And so it was really important for me to get away from that, or to realize that, you know, there's this whole other world that exists. And so I started my Bookstagram almost 3 years ago now, and that was a way specifically for me to be more intentional about finding more Asian and Asian American authors, and not only supporting them, but also finding myself in these stories.
Adam says that his mom was his tether, and he sought out the Asian community around Milwaukee, the same one that his mom was a leader in. And one thing they always had in their house to ground them was food.
What our family calls chow mein is not what you order on a restaurant menu. It isn't the sort of, like, the noodles that are sort of crusty, and then you get them in sauce, and then they soften up, and they can be very nice. But these are kind of these twice-fried noodles that have a special sauce. It's kind of derived from soy sauce. And my mom would make them for the most special occasions, so maybe like once or twice a year. Like, there were five of us, so it couldn't be for birthdays. And if, like, you got it for your birthday, everyone else was mad, but you'd still eat the chow mein. The next day, we'd always, like, we were a sleepy family. We'd wake up as early as we possibly could to eat that chow mein, because it would not make it to, like, noon. It would not make it to lunch. Like, if chow mein made it to lunch, it's because some of the family was out of the house. Like, it was impossible, especially when we were all there. But chow mein was just, like, my eyes just got big thinking about it. like it would be smoky and it would be long, like hot, and she'd do it in summer and it'd be all sweaty. But the chow mein feels like where I'm from. I didn't really know where I was from, but I could eat some noodles and feel good.
I mean, for a lot of us, in the absence of language, you know, we have food. And it helped me feel connected to my grandparents when I couldn't really communicate with them. My grandfather, we called him Ong, he passed away a few years ago. And his younger brother's entire family came to town for the funeral. This was like a 20-person branch of the family that we didn't know that well.
Where were they coming from?
They were coming from like Florida and Kentucky, kind of all over the place. But we just didn't see them that much. To me, they just seemed more Vietnamese than us in this really hardcore way. That was cool, but, you know, in my family, we have a lot more mixing, and they were just, like, fully Vietnamese, and all the kids could speak the language. They wanted to honor Ong because he helped them evacuate from Vietnam and come to the U.S. in the 70s. So before the funeral, they cooked us this huge pot of bong bao hui. It was, like, a pot that you could, like, fit a small child into. It was so big.
Okay.
It's this spicy lemongrass noodle soup. It was so amazing. They, like, took over the entire kitchen. They put, like, newspapers on my parents' floor so that they wouldn't spill or make a mess. And they were all, like, squatting on the floor and, like, cleaning out the herbs for our soup. And it was crazy. It was, like, seeing this alternate universe of what our family could have been. And it was, like, festive and beautiful, and I felt connected to them. But at the same time, I was, like, part of this is unfamiliar. So, like, at the same time that there is connection, you're feeling, like, the absence of something, too.
Mm-hmm.
That was Adam Carr, Kayla Kuo, and Lena Tran. That piece was produced by WUWM's Jimmy Gutierrez. And did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. In about 15 minutes, we'll continue to highlight our favorite conversations from the year. We'll speak with the founder of Kothi Dance Company, which celebrated 55 years in 2024, and over a million children impacted in Milwaukee. But first, we'll visit La Finca Coffee House and learn about the sisters who started it. That's next on Lake Effect. On 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. In October this year, La Finca Coffee House celebrated its 7th anniversary as a family business in St. Francis. The sisters behind the Mexican-inspired coffee shop are Janeth and Lizette Zuria. They opened the shop in 2017, sourcing coffee beans from their grandfather's farm in Oaxaca, Mexico. On top of celebrating a 7-year milestone, they also earned a $10,000 grant from BMO's Celebrating Women Grant Program. Lake Effect's Excret Nunez visited them at the coffee shop to talk about what inspired them to open La Finca and how the grant will help them build up their business.
For people who aren't familiar with La Finca, can you tell me a bit about your backstory and why did you both decide to open this coffee shop?
So the biggest and most important part of our story is that we were raised undocumented in the United States. I came over here when I was 3, turning 4, and she was 1. And I wanted to create something with my sister that not only highlighted our culture, but represented our family in a certain way so that we could get roots here, which felt kind of complicated at the time to establish roots in a country that didn't want us. And so in 2012, we were granted DACA, which was amazing. And in 2016, we decided to apply for advanced parole, which sounds really crazy and scary. And it was at a time that nobody was really doing it. It had just kind of rolled out. But advanced parole basically gave us a sheet of paper that said, yes, you can leave the United States for X amount of time, and we guarantee that you will be allowed back in. So when we traveled to Oaxaca, meeting my dad's side of the family, the 3 weeks were amazing. Emotional, I remember flying in with her, and we're holding hands, and I can't stop crying because it feels like home in a place that was so foreign to me. And we get to meet our grandparents, our great aunts, cousins, everybody in that short time frame. And in that trip, our grandfather puts coffee bags into our suitcases, and he's like, just try it, you know, have your friends try it. And every evening it was, let's sit down, talk about our day over a cup of coffee, every evening. And it was always in a little like tacita, you know, like traditional of Oaxaca. And we loved that storytelling. We loved being able to just decompress after a day. And we wanted that, like connection that we felt here. So coming back, I started sharing that coffee. I myself didn't drink it. But I started learning how to make pour over, started infusing different flavors to try to like have something different while connecting us back to Mexico. And I think like the forming of Finca, establishing like our business plan, we really mapped out kind of the roles that our family would fit in because we knew we wanted to involve them. You know, this was for them. So we're like, my dad can help us with the ordering process. My mom's, her recipes is everything we do. And even though we didn't do food right at the beginning, we knew we were going to incorporate it because everybody needs a little something to go with their coffee. But yeah, that was the beginning of it, and we learned a lot, but I think that business plan really helped us stay focused and grounded to continue our path to growing what we have 7 years later.
And I also want to like mention for people who are interested in getting to know La Finca, where does the name La Finca come from?
So La Finca comes from when we were younger. We always knew that my grandfather owned a coffee farm in Oaxaca. The farm's been in the family for about 5 generations, so we heard stories of when my dad was younger being raised on there, working on the farm, and we've heard so many stories about it, but we never knew what the farm was called. We just called it La Finca. So when we started thinking and workshopping ideas for our space here, that one just kind of stuck out because it's what we always called Grandpa's Farm, and that's where we're sourcing all of our coffee from, is Grandpa's Farm. So it just felt natural to call it La Finca.
So I also want to like mention the location of your coffee shop. You know, it isn't something that maybe people easily stumble upon. So how did you guys decide on having the coffee shop here?
So I saw an ad for it the day that the previous coffee shop closed. And that same day I drove out here and I was like, I'm familiar with the area because we went to high school at Thomas More. And I'm looking around and I'm like, I love the lake views. People can sit outside. And we already knew we were going to bring our mugs. So we were like, can you imagine people sitting here enjoying a cafecito and making this look more like what we miss? So when we made the business plan, it was revolving around this. And it was difficult. We wouldn't have had the same foot traffic had we gone to somewhere in the South Side. We wouldn't have had our community, you know, the community that we were raised around, that we grew up with, the South Side Hispanics, you know. And so that was a challenge. Can we bring our people here? And we sat down, we had the conversation, we're like, let's take that risk, you know, let's try to see who's gonna come out to this little part of town. And it is super small, you know. So for me specifically, being able to see the amount of Black and brown people that come to this side of town, I think that was probably the most important factor for me to be able to be here, is to be able to draw a crowd that creates diversity in this neighborhood, because Milwaukee's so segregated and that needs to change.
You mentioned like the coffee itself comes from your grandfather's farm. What have been some of like the challenges of doing something so unique and interesting of directly importing the beans from his farm?
So I think the biggest challenge in the beginning was figuring out the direct source of it, right? We know we want to work with him. How do we get a rural area in Oaxaca to be able to send their packages to the city so that then they can send it over to us? So that in and itself was tricky. Once we got the help of family from down there, uncles, cousins that were like, yes, I'll package it. We'll bring it down to the city. Even to this day, we only send packages in groups of like 5 to 10. And the reason for that is security. In the beginning, I can't tell you how many packages we lost in transit. They would just disappear. We wouldn't be able to track them anywhere. And that was a huge loss for us because we were investing to be able to get this coffee specifically. Currently now we work with, alongside my grandfather, a woman-owned coffee farm in Oaxaca as well. And the stability has been much better. So for the last, I want to say at least 3 years, we haven't had any issues, which has been very reassuring. And that gives us more incentive to try to grow in that fashion. But that is something that we look forward to next year, to be able to continue the path of sourcing our coffee directly from farmers so that we can grow our taste profile in shop.
Absolutely. And so just to kind of also bring up that you both recently earned that $10,000 grant from BMO's 2024 Celebrating Women Grant Program, what inspired you to apply for this grant specifically?
So it was like a three-part application process, essentially. The first part was just answering questions about the business and where we see ourselves in the future, how a grant like this is going to be beneficial to our business. We met all of the criteria for this grant, which is not always easy given our mixed legal status. And then once we passed the first round, there was a little video submission, which made us a little nervous because we're both camera shy. And after that, they announced the winners, and we were insanely, like,
we were floored.
We were floored. Yeah. I was not expecting. I wanted to apply just because it was a good opportunity, but I had no expectation of winning this. So wow. It's going to be huge for our business. We started roasting this year. We started a partnership with Bellwether Roasting, which allows us to literally roast in-house. We're hoping to use all of those, the big majority of those funds from the grant, to be able to expand that part. We want to start offering coffee as a retail option for our customers, as well as a wholesale option for any, you know, neighboring cafes or restaurants that want to carry our coffee. So that's a big project that's completely new to us that we are very fortunate enough to have help from BMO to be able to see that through and help it grow.
Right, that is a big goal, and I didn't realize that you guys had just started roasting this year. Mm-hmm. That's amazing. Before we wrap up our lovely conversation, I want to go back to something that you mentioned earlier. I think you both mentioned this. How have you seen your business create community over the past 7 years since you originally set out to do that?
Something very important that Lisa touched on was promoting diversity in our community. It's evident when you walk in the shop how much diversity there is. And it's a point of pride for us to be able to say that it's because they're coming here. They're coming to La Finca to get some coffee and chat with friends. I think that's one of the biggest ways we've seen community grow throughout the 7 years that we've been here. But outside of that, there's been numerous partnerships that we've been able to make along the way and encourage just growth between not just other businesses, but entrepreneurs in the area. Some good friends of ours that actually own the 414 brand in Milwaukee, we partner with them a few times a year to put together something called a Mercadito, where we host 15 or so, whatever fits in our little space, entrepreneurs that come and sell their goods here. So we're opening our doors to other businesses in the area to come and share their products, share their story, and collaborate so that they get to share that with our community here. So those are probably some of my favorite ways we've been able to see community grow here.
Yeah, I love that. It definitely seems like you guys have created like a safe space and a really creative space too. And so thank you guys for welcoming me here. And it was really great to chat with you both.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Janeth and Lizette Zaria are sisters and co-owners of La Finca Coffee House. They spoke with Lake Effect's expert Nunez at their shop in St. Francis in October. Still to come, we'll learn about Kothi Dance Company, which celebrated 55 years in Milwaukee this year. That's next on Lake Effect, on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Kothi Dance Company celebrated 55 years in Milwaukee in 2024. The company, founded by Fern Cocker in 1969, performs and teaches dance and music created by Africans and the African diaspora. Cocker joined me earlier this year to explore the roots of this company and how they're celebrating its 5.5 decades in existence. How do you describe Kothi Dance Company?
You know, we have always, and I guess at the beginning when I started the company, it was in Ghana, actually, in 1969. I was sitting on the sands looking out at the Atlantic Ocean right outside of the slave fort called Elmina Castle, which was supported by the British, the Portuguese, and the Americans were all part of that slave trade. And as I was sitting there looking out toward the fort in 1969, and then was sitting there on the beach, and I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do as an artist. And I know that the African dance and music was very close to my heart, having been born there and then moving here to the United States. So that's when a revelation came for me to start a dance group to see if I could become a connector between the African arts and aesthetics and the continent and African-Americans over here. The name Kothi came from my father's language, the Shebro people in Sierra Leone. He was African and had met my mother at the University of Chicago, who was African-American, and then they went to Sierra Leone. And it means go black. Go black is a color. The color black is thi, but I wanted it to refer to black culture, wherever that is in the diaspora. So from the very beginning, when I created the company, I've always thought of it as growing it into being this accessible place where people could touch tone the African continent through the aesthetics of the African continent. And then that took us on a journey from 1969 to present, researching and developing and creating and teaching wherever Africans ended up. Because for us to be on this journey, we couldn't ignore the process of enslavement, because the question is, how did Africans end up in Brazil and how did those black people end up in the Caribbean? We can't just suddenly, you know, wipe that out and ignore what happened. There's a reason why all those people ended up in the South and ended up in Brazil, in South America, and ended up in the Caribbean. So with them was an embodiment of music, song, dance, aesthetics, art, theater, poetry, literature. And so that's what we do in Kothi. We study this, we bring master teachers in, and that's been our mission to promulgate, or as they say, to spread, to give people an opportunity to explore. And this is a long definition, but it's not about, this is just for black people, because when I guess one of the problems I'm having today, this will probably take us down another road, but is it this movement that you can't teach black history with the rawness of what actually happened, because it might offend children who are descendants of people who potentially were some of the perpetrators. But that is a losing and a really sad, sad argument, because that means that all these years in my life, the first 40 years of my life, and I'm in my mid-70s, past mid-70s now, that I should have been offended all those years when I was just learning Greek mythology and British history as a child from the colonial era. I should have been offended because I wasn't learning anything about people who looked like me. So those arguments just don't wash with me.
That kind of gets to my next question for you. Going back to 1969 when you founded Kothi, what was the dance scene like in Milwaukee?
Oh, my God. Well, you know, in the 60s, well, you weren't born then, I don't think. But in the 60s, you know, that was, you know, I'm Black and I'm Proud. And it was the whole renaissance in the Black community of touchstoning something that was cultural, the dashikis and the afros and all of that. That was a very interesting period of time where there was a lot of interest. You know, Osibisa, the Ghanaian band, had written a song called Welcome Home, which was really interesting because they played that when we went back this, just when I went this time in 2023, 24, you know, they were playing their song that they wrote in the 60s to the African-Americans who had just landed when we got to the airport. That's what they played. And so, you know, that whole era of Black dance and, you know, Alvin Ailey was inside of that milieu. Catherine Dunham, all these people, Chief Bey, Rod Rogers, all these Black choreographers were very active and their companies had just started and they were very, very visible. So it was a full range of music, song, and dance that was going on. People were doing African dance and playing African drums, even though they hadn't trained in any of it because nobody was really exposed until around, I'd say, the 70s when we started getting national dance companies from Africa touring the world and they would stop off like in Chicago. Or Les Ballets Africains, for example, came to Milwaukee and people started seeing the real deal and studying. And then people started going to Africa to study and then bringing African artists back to the Milwaukee area. And that's how it built.
As you look back at the last five decades of Kothi in Milwaukee, how do you think it has changed and affected the dance scene and the art scene more generally in Milwaukee?
One of the things I'm most proud of, and I think those of us who are in the current leadership in the organization, is that we teach on multiple levels. In terms of impact, I'm a part of a group called SMAC, a small arts core. There's 11 of us that are fundraising to raise funds to so we can keep our organizations afloat. And one of the tasks we had was to lay out in all the years that we've been functioning, how many children we've reached, blah, 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 blah. And when I started putting it all and adding it together, I realized, oh my God, Kothi has touched over 1 million children in our 54 years, going into the 55th year. You can't put money on that. I mean, it would be nice if somebody would say, you know what, this story really makes me want to send them a check. It would be nice to have some money but there is no fund large enough to equate that human experience. So I feel that Kothi is not just about teaching children and teaching the community and having classes and exposing all children, all races, all ages and humans, but it's about affecting not only the person in the class, but who they affect when they leave the class or they come back into the classroom. So I know that we have, after five decades, a long, long history with not just individuals, but with them and their families. We have a long, long history as the oldest African-American Black arts organization in the state of Wisconsin. And that's something to be celebrated. That can't be taken away from us. Not a perfect organization, by no means, but our legacy is real clear.
Yeah. Now, Kothi is celebrating its 55th anniversary, which is a big accomplishment for any organization, but especially a dance company.
Yes. In this day and age, yes.
Yeah. How are you planning to celebrate these 55 years this year? What are the performances that you have lined up?
Right now, there's some key things happening. One of the things we decided to do was, in terms of image, you know, what was going to be our theme for this year? And one of the natural things that has always fascinated me in my trips to Africa is the baobab tree, which is a very ancient tree like the redwoods. And it looks like an upside down tree with the roots at the top and great big root system. In the old days, they used to bury the griots or the storytellers inside of the roots of the baobab tree. So we decided that we wanted to honor that tree and its legacy and how old some of those trees can be. the 55th year celebration is called Under the Baobab Tree. And we have a series of events that are going to harness and bring everybody together, alumni and the community. There'll be more things that we'll be announcing into the fall and to the end of the year.
A lot to look forward to. Fern, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect, and congratulations on this really momentous anniversary.
I appreciate you, Joy.
Fern Cocker is the founder and executive director of Kothee Dance Company. We spoke in February. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll bring you more of our favorite interviews from 2024, including a conversation with longtime Milwaukee Alderman Michael Murphy, who retired this year. Plus, we'll learn about a popular exhibit at the Milwaukee Public Museum and why it isn't moving to the new facility. That's all tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.